in verse 27, where the Apostle Paul says that he wanted them to sing in church with the spirit and with the understanding. And the kind of the takeaway from that passage in 1 Corinthians 14 was that the important thing is that we understand the words that we're singing to God. And then last week, we spent a little bit of time talking about the two statements in Ephesians and Galatians about singing and how the Apostle Paul talks about the kinds of songs that we sing, psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. And as we were thinking about that, it seems apparent to me that the early church in many ways used the psalms as the basis for the things that they sang, the things that they sang in the corporate assembly, 1 Corinthians 14, verse 37, and the kinds of things that they thought about every day. And we think about many things in psalms, you know, or in songs. You what do they call that? A brain worm, when you hear a song and you just can't get rid of it in your thought process. Well, I think the apostle, he says, don't be drunk with wine, but get in the habit of thinking about these brain worms, these psalms, and keep repeating them, and let that be the thing that fills your heart. So tonight, I'd like to kind of conclude this by looking at the extra biblical information. We just don't have any biblical information about what the early church did other than 1 Corinthians 14. And that's really the only information that we have about singing in the corporate worship or the assembled worship. So we're going to have to turn to some extra biblical, some information that comes from sources other than the Bible to understand what the early church's practice was in terms of singing. So we're going to talk about a couple of ideas. We're going to talk about the development of the practice of singing, and we'll do that in terms of how we kind of started out with the idea of harmony. And we usually in the church, we sing four-part harmony. How did we get there? So we kind of try to trace the history of the development of that kind of singing. And then a second aspect of this is to look at how we got to the point where we sing songs other than the psalms. And many of the psalms we saw last week, they kind of lend themselves to what we're going to talk about tonight, and we'll try to tie all of this together. So let's begin. The earliest information that I can find about singing and the early Christians comes from a letter that Pliny the Younger, who was the governor of Bithynia, sent to the Emperor Trajan in Rome. And when you read Pliny's letter, you kind of get the impression that he's the ultimate sycophant or the ultimate suck up. And so he's doing some things to garner the favor of Trajan. Now you have to understand that from the vantage point of a Roman governor out in one of the provinces, the worst possible thing that could happen was to have any kind of unrest or any kind of civil disobedience. So Pliny is dealing with a situation where at the time that he writes this, probably 61 to 65, we don't know the date of the letter exactly, but at the time that Pliny writes this, for the most part, the Christians are considered a rabble-rousing sect of the Jews. And the Christians and the Jews were having difficulty. Well, that is going to disturb Pliny. So he writes to Trajan and he says, what am I supposed to do about these Christians? There was no law that they were violating. And in fact, at this time in the Roman Empire, the Jews are pretty much allowed to continue to worship Jehovah. As long as they don't create any kind of civil unrest. So this is what Pliny writes to Trajan about some Christians who had, or some people who had been accused of being Christians and what they had to say in their own defense. This is the part of his letter that I'm really interested in. He says, they, that's these accused Christians, they asserted that the sum and substance of their fault or error had been that they were accustomed to meet on a fixed day. And of course, we know that that was Sunday. They were accustomed to meet on a fixed day before dawn and sing responsively a hymn to Christ as to a God. Now, remember, this is what Pliny writes. So he is not a Christian himself. And he's just writing to Trajan saying, what do I do with these folks? They've been accused. And this was what they said they had done. They met on a fixed day, Sunday, before dawn, and they would sing responsively. Don't know exactly what that means. Pliny didn't go any further into it. And Trajan's response, by the way, is really interesting. Trajan said, well, as long as they're not a problem, as long as they're not creating civil unrest, then just kind of leave them alone. It was kind of a don't ask, don't tell response that Trajan had. So we come down in history a little bit and we get to a 5th century church historian. And this 5th century church historian, he's a Greek. His name is Socrates of Constantinople, not the Socrates, but Socrates of Constantinople. And he suggests that what the early Christians were doing, he describes as antiphony. And I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Socrates suggests that this was introduced into worship by a man named Ignatius of Antioch. And Ignatius died in 107 AD. So this is Socrates, who never met Ignatius, couldn't have met him, but he says this was the origin of antiphony. And he says Ignatius started this practice in worship based on what he saw in a vision. Now, you have to take this with a grain of salt because this is not firsthand information. This is hearsay information. Ignatius said he saw a vision of two choirs of angels. And he described what he saw as antiphonal psalmody. In other words, you had singing psalms by alternating groups of performers or alternating groups of singers. sometimes this is called a call and response kind of singing. And remember when we went through the Psalms and we were talking about the great Paschal Psalms that were always sung at the end of the Passover? Remember how they had those repeated refrains? If you look at Psalms 115, 16, 17, 18, right in there, you see those Psalms that have the repeated refrains. Well, the leader would read the first choir would sing or chant the first part of that psalm, and then it would be responded to by the other choir, and they would say, "Blessed is the Lord our God," or something like that. So you had a statement or a call, and then a response. Now, this kind of singing, according to most of the authorities that I can find, is related to something called cantillation. You're probably, or at one point or another, have probably heard the term a Jewish cantor. Well, the cantors were a special group of learned Jewish individuals. Every synagogue would have their group of cantors. And these cantors did something very special when they read the law. So I looked up the idea of cantillation. That's what you would call what the cantors did. That's C-A-N-T-O-R-S. They practiced cantillation. And cantillation was chanting ritualized readings from the Hebrew scriptures during synagogue services. And if you've ever heard a cantor, it's kind of a sing-songy kind of reading, but it's not tonal up and down like we think of singing, but it's really kind of a monotone, but they really exaggerate the feeling that was in the Psalms. It turns out that these chants that the cantors practiced were written down. There was a whole book that had been assembled of these chants. And you remember when we talked about the development of the canon? We talked about the Masoretic text, where the Masorite Christians took the Jewish language. And remember, Hebrew has no vowels and it has no punctuation. It's just a bunch of run-on letters. Well, the Masoretes took this big run-on text and they put in vowel points and they put in accent points and they put in the breaks between words. And the cantors were the people that followed the Masoretic text, and they chanted the Psalms. So they're using the breaks, they're using the phrasing that the Masoretes had supplied, they're accenting according to the Masoretic text. It was monotone, but what I can read is that the cantillation marks or cantillation signs had a musical value. And language, if you think about it for a minute, has a music all its own, even when it's spoken. I did a lot of research on how people read. when I was a school psychologist. And some people kind of read the words that are on a page with a flat affect. There's no breaks. They don't read the punctuation. It's just words, one after another. And I tend to think of this as being what you had with the earliest voice over data recordings that you would get if you called a business. You remember how they would read the numbers back to you of the extension that you wanted, and they read it kind of like this: 5, 7, 8, 9. And that's not the way we talk. It's not natural. Now, the voice recordings that you get, the digitized human voice, it sounds like a person. They don't say 9, 4, 7, 7, 3, 8. They say it like a person would say it. Well, that's recognizing the music of the written word. And my research that I did, when you read the punctuation and you read like you talk, it makes it much more understandable. Your comprehension level goes way up if you'll read the punctuation. And one of the things that we learned was that poor readers tend to read real flat without any inflection in their voice. And it doesn't go up at the end of the sentence when it's a question. And if it's a declarative sentence, it doesn't go down. That's kind of based on what the Cantors were doing in their reading of the text. You remember that statement back in Nehemiah when they discovered the law, and it says they read the text and gave the sense? Most Jewish scholars say that what they did was they canted the text, like a cantor would read it. They read it with all the breaks and all the ups and downs, and your voice goes kind of quiet in places, and it responds to an exclamation point by getting a little bit louder. Well, that's what the cantors did, and that was called giving the sense of the text. It probably doesn't refer to reading the text and then trying to explain it in your own words. It most probably referred to this practice of the cantors, because the way that they read made it so much more understandable. Has anybody else experience that kind of thing? When you hear some people read and they have this musical quality to their voice, it goes up and down and quieter and louder, and they emphasize certain syllables. Does that make it easier to understand what the written word says?
Yes. Some people, when they read the Bible and when they get up in front and read the Bible, that it's more difficult to understand what they're saying because they say it rather in a monotone rather than emphasizing different phrases.
Right. And there are some, I agree with Ann, there are some people that I have heard read a particular passage, and after I listen to them read it, I think, well, that's what it's talking about. And all they did was read the same words that I've read over and over and over again. It's just that they read it with the punctuation. And we typically would say they read it with feeling. In the world of modern research on reading, that's called reading with prosody, prosody. And so several researchers and I at Eastern Washington University were trying to put together a way to measure how well people read with prosody, because we were of the belief that this increased the level of comprehension. So that's what this was all based on. They're basing their singing the Psalms on the way that the cantors would sing the Psalms. Go ahead, Gerald.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was just practicing.
Okay. Well, this is probably what the early Christians were doing, because their practice from reading Acts was very much like what had been going on in the synagogues. That's what their background was. They came from Jewish synagogues. So let's come up to the time of the Reformation. This method of singing, reading, chanting, probably persisted until the period of the Reformation. And then, during the Reformation, it seems that there were two trains of thought that kind of emerged about singing and what singing should be. The Calvinists and those that followed Calvin and his thought processes, the Calvinists contended basically that anything that didn't come word for word from the Bible was to be rejected. In other words, you couldn't paraphrase it. You couldn't change it in any way. You had to read exactly what the biblical information said. Now, that's not an unheard of kind of approach to thinking about what's written on the page. If you're really kind of into words the way that I am, look at the word plagiarism. Plagiarism arose during the time of the Romans. When the Romans came to power, they had no literary background at all. In fact, a lot of people suggest that the Romans didn't even have a written language. They conquered the Greeks and they kind of stole what the Greeks had for their literary background. And then the Romans set about to translate it into this newly developed Latin language, but the thought was that they had to translate it exactly. You couldn't add things to what you were translating into Latin. Even though it was a translation, you were changing the words, but you had to translate exactly. And the idea of plagiarism originally meant that you added your own interpretation to it. It's a really interesting word. It's turned around 180 degrees. Now we say you're plagiarizing if you quote somebody. They said you were plagiarizing if you didn't quote somebody. So Calvinists believe that you should only chant what was originally written. Now, originally written, of course, it was originally written in Hebrew. They weren't chanting it in Hebrew. They were chanting it in Greek. or they were chanting it in the German language as they began to translate this. Luther, of course, during this period of time, he's involved in translating into the common vernacular. But this approach that the Calvinists took has been called exclusive psalmody. In other words, you were exclusively going to use the Psalms as the text for what your songs were, and your songs were chanted after the matter of the after the manner of the cantors. Luther didn't take that approach. Luther approached the idea of singing as if it was an opportunity to teach what the faith said to new worshipers. So, while the Calvinists and exclusive psalmody focused on the idea of giving praise to God, Luther kind of expanded this and said that part of singing was to teach. And you can see where he gets that. It's this, it comes from the statements in Ephesians and Galatians that we speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. So the English writers, particularly at this time, started to paraphrase biblical text. They didn't quote it exactly, but they paraphrased it. And we sing some songs that came out of that tradition. We sing the 23rd Psalm. And for the most part, the 23rd Psalm doesn't exactly follow what's written in your Bibles. It's a paraphrase. It's changed a little bit. But if you listen to the words when we sing the 23rd Psalm, the Lord is my shepherd, it's really pretty clear that that comes from Psalms 23. So the English writers started to paraphrase biblical text. Now that would have been described by the Romans as plagiarism. Isaac Watts was an English songwriter who followed this paraphrase tradition in a great many of the songs that he wrote. But Isaac Watts is the first person who's credited with having written the first English song to be sung in the church that was not based on a direct paraphrase of the scriptures, but instead was based on the poem that Isaac Watts had written. So it's the introduction of secular poetry. Later writers following this tradition took even more freedom than Isaac Watts did, and some of them started using allegory and they started using metaphor in the songs that they were writing. And we're really familiar with that. Jesus, the Lamb of God, and how we kind of focus on the idea of the Lamb. Wesley, Charles Wesley, took this kind of developing idea of the song one step further. And Wesley wrote songs that were intended to express his personal feelings about his relationship with God. So you had the exclusive psalmody. We only sing what's written in the Psalms. Then you had this Lutheran teaching tradition. And now Wesley goes beyond that, and he talks in his songs that he was writing, he starts talking about personal feelings. Those had never been a part of Calvinist thought, and it really wasn't a part of Lutheran thought either. So during the Second Great Awakening in America, you had the use of the Negro spirituals that had characterized that Black African culture during a time of slavery. And a lot of that was call and response kind of singing. And that got picked up and it got brought into the evangelistic crusades. Now, remember, that was one of the hallmarks of the Second Great Awakening in America. They had these big tent meetings or these big crusades. And so you had people that were writing songs that were intended for these big crusades, and they tended to focus on the way that people felt, and they were call and response kinds of songs. An interesting bit of information that I ran across as I was doing the research for this was that these songs that were based on the African spirituals tended to be divided into what people at that time called the song category and the hymn category. So a hymn wouldn't have a refrain or a chorus, kind of like Amazing Grace. That's a paraphrase of a hymn, or a hymn that's a paraphrase of the Psalms, or based on that idea, but there's no refrain in Amazing Grace. There's no chorus. And then there are songs that feature the chorus, like Blessed Assurance. Blessed Assurance, Jesus is mine. Oh, what a foretaste of glory divine. This is how you feel. And then it goes into the chorus, and you sing the chorus every time at the end of one of the verses. So this distinction that they drew between spiritual songs and hymns, that's not a biblical distinction. Remember, we talked about the notion of psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. That's not derived from Ephesians and Galatians. That's something that came about during the time of the big evangelistic crusades. And a lot of songs were written about that time. A lot of songs were written during the period of the Civil War as well. And they were written to be sung typically as marching songs. It was a way to keep everybody in step and a way to keep everybody moving forward. And we still have that military tradition today. In the military, and I think, I don't know if they do as much marching as they used to. Matt could probably tell us about that, but in the military, they would sing these chants, and that was kind of the way they kept everybody going at the same pace. Now, so we understand the development of the words in the songs. What about the development of harmony or different tones in the songs, different musical notes in the songs? And I have to say, as I start talking about this, that this goes over my head. I was talking to Nolan about this at lunch, and Nolan has a much better musical background than I do, and And Amelia's sister has an even better understanding of all of this. I feel terribly ill-prepared to talk about the development of harmony and the use of different notes in singing. But I'll tell you what I can distill from the research that I read. This is called polyphony. Remember we talked about antiphony? That's the words in response to each other, but it was typically kind of a monotone kind of thing. Polyphony is the use of different musical notes, and there's not much information about when these musical notes began to be used in singing in churches. And remember, we said a cappella is after the manner of the chapel. We kind of unfairly restrict that term a cappella to mean unaccompanied, but it's after the manner of the chapel. Well, in Western church music, there are two really famous, although I've never heard of them, but apparently these are the seminal works. The, I can't even pronounce that, Musica Incariatis or something like that, and Scolica Incariatis. I need somebody that knows how to read that. These essays or treatises were written probably around 900. And they're considered by most scholars to be the oldest extant written examples of polyphony, or using different musical notes. And these treatises provide examples of two voices, one note, one voice singing one note and another voice singing a different note. It was usually a call and response kind of thing, but they say that these developed using what are called parallel octaves. Octave to me is a group of eight notes and then it repeats, and I don't know what parallel octaves are. And then it was based on fifths and fourths. And I think from what Nolan was telling me at lunch that this may be major and minor chords. It's way over my head. I don't understand it. But I think what we can see from this is the idea of harmony is a relatively recent introduction into the music that, or the singing that was a cappella or after the manner of the chapel. I've read quite a bit about what was happening during the period when radio was in its ascendancy, and there were singing groups that became very, very famous. They were typically going to sing music that would be used in churches. They did it typically without any accompaniment by an instrument, and most of these guys had regular full-time jobs. They just would get together and they would sing over the radio. And some of them became really famous. My dad tells a story about when he was just a little boy and he was going to church, and they typically would have singings on the fifth Sunday, whenever the fifth Sunday in a month occurred. And churches would kind of get together, and they'd have everybody meet in one place, and then different leaders would lead different songs. And my dad tells a story about a fellow that got up and led this song, and he said, "I learned that from the Foggy Mountain Boys." That's the way that people learned the music that they sang. They kind of imitated what these groups were singing, and it wasn't necessarily written down. They didn't typically have the music, and they certainly didn't have the words up on the screen behind the song leader. Everybody just kind of sang from memory. Well, that has developed into the idea of having singing schools where song leaders typically go to school to learn how to lead songs. It's not a lot different than what we saw when we were talking about the restoration history, and we saw the development of schools for preachers. Well, you had these singing schools that kind of came out of that same tradition. So my conclusion from all of this is the way that we sing and the things that we sing have largely developed over time. And we sing a lot of songs today that weren't sung 50 years ago. We don't sing some of what we call the old standards because they just feel like they're very dated to us, and it's not after the manner that we typically see in music today. So I think we have to be aware of how we got to where we are and not be terribly dogmatic about not singing new songs and not singing and wanting to sing the old songs. And you know, when I was a much younger preacher, I preached at one time about the songs that you would typically hear sung at some place like Calvary Chapel. And I made the point that they're songs that don't teach very much. They're just feel good kind of repetitions. And all you get is a chorus, and and it's just sung over and over again. And there's not much thought behind it. And I compared that to being babes in Christ. And I think I probably went overboard. So you have exhausted, or I have exhausted, everything I know about singing. And it's not much. There are a lot of people who have done a lot of research into these kinds of things that I just, about all I can do is tell you the results of the research that I can read that they've published. I really can't do much more than that. So any questions or comments about our singing in general?
Well, I do think it's interesting that the four-part harmony that we do today is really not related at all to what the New Testament church did. And I find that very, very interesting. And we're kind of married to this four-part harmony. And we kind of think that that is the traditional worship, and it's really not. It's kind of morphed into this, which I don't have an issue with. I think that we're still worshiping God, and we're still praising Him with our songs, and we're singing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. But I do find it interesting that it's very different than what the first century church did.
Yeah, from everything that I can read about worship in the first century church, I think you're right. We do sing some chants. Not very many. And right now I can't think of one. But we sing some chants that are just one note. We sing it all the way through. Everybody sings the same note. Yeah, Carol?
Yeah, Dean, to go back to one of your earlier lessons, at least ways I think it was there, the idea of you say a cappella is in the chapel and not necessarily without music, but I'm not quite sure when the dating is, how far back the fact that they didn't use any instruments were.
The instruments probably weren't introduced from what I can figure out reading history. The instruments probably were never introduced until about the 900s. A cappella was generally chanted songs until about that time.
Okay, that's the one biblical example that we can go to as far as the fact that the musical instrument was the basically the heart. You pluck the heart with understanding, and that's sort of really has been interesting to hear the difference of how we've gone into Flora Part and some of this other stuff. But the intention is, I think, still the same.
Yeah, I agree with you. Interestingly, the first instrument that I could find that was used in the chapel, in cappella, would have been a harp. And I don't know of anybody anymore that uses a harp. And there's this whole fascinating discussion about the development of carols, and you had carols. We tend to use that term carols to refer to songs that we sing around December the 25th. But there were carols that were written that were used for other celebrations that were a part of Catholic worship, that we don't sing anymore. One of the first carols that was written was Silent Night, and that originally was accompanied by a guitar. So maybe we've come full circle on that one. It was originally written to the accompaniment of a guitar, and then it got to be something else, and now we're kind of getting back to the accompaniment by a guitar in American folk music.